Hello and welcome to this week's Key Voices, conversations with folk in and around education. I'm Caroline Doherty. We are doing a series of podcasts with the Centre for Education and Youth, the Think and Action Tank, formerly known as LKMCO. We'll talk a bit about that in a minute with my guest. We are going to be looking into their research in some detail, and today's episode we are going to be talking about school cultures with Dr. Sam Bars, Director of Research at the Centre for Education and Youth. Hello, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, do you want to explain to us a little bit about what the centre actually does?
Sure, so we are the Centre for Education and Youth. Until very recently we were LKMCO, and then we reached 10 years of age, something we were really excited about, and also felt that we did need to change our name so that it reflected what we did a bit better. Mm-hmm. We're now the Centre for Education and Youth, or CFEY. We carry out research within the sector to look at young people's lives, the education system, and the ways that we can help society to ensure that young people make fulfilling transitions to adulthood. We also influence, so we are out and about in the media quite mm-hmm. a lot, either publicising our own research or just getting involved in the discussions and debates that matter most, and influencing the policy process, consultations and things like this. So we try to bridge that gap between the people who think and ruminate and the people who are at the coalface every day doing the stuff. So we, for instance, all the research that we do, we always have very concrete, practical recommendations for people to then carry that forward and actually affect change. And then a lot of the work we do is then evaluating how well they do that to see if they have an impact on young people's lives.
Great stuff. And we're going to dig into some of your work in a bit more detail. Now, we're going to talk about your research report looking at school cultures, high-performing schools that really deliver for children who are disadvantaged. Could you give us a quick overview of the research that you did?
Yeah, sure. So this is a report that we put out just over a year ago now. It was a piece of research for the Department for Education, and it was part of a wider programme of research that they've now concluded. So we're going back about 2 or 3 years ago that they started this mm-hmm. research. And it was looking at the London effect. So this is the effect that probably first came on the radar probably about 7 years ago now. People began to notice when we looked at the data that something seemed different about London schools. Mm. Broadly speaking, they seemed to outperform the rest of the country, and particularly for disadvantaged young people, so for kids on free school meals, broadly speaking, London schools seemed to do particularly well at serving those kids. Since then, in the intervening years, there's been lots and lots of research trying to figure out why that's the case.
Yeah.
Are they better schools? Are they just working with different types of kids from different backgrounds that makes the job for schools easier? Are they just funded better? Mm. Is London as a city just yeah. different to the rest of the country? Lots of different hypotheses. And as part of really trying to dig into some of those causal claims, the department wanted us to do some detailed qualitative work. So having lots of conversations, spending lots of time in individual schools to get under the hood of cultures and practices. Mm. So I think one way of looking at that is it's almost the stuff you can't see in a school.
Yeah.
They wanted us to go and spend some time looking at stuff that you can't see, which sounds a bit odd. But everyone kind of knows that thing, when you step into a school, from the school gates to reception and then onwards, you get a feeling, you get a vibe,
yeah.
and things happen in certain ways. There's a certain kind of culture. And if you stay for long enough, you do start to be able to detect that and put it down in words. So that's what we attempted to do. And the department essentially wanted to know if schools in London and schools with a much smaller gap in attainment mm-hmm. between free school meal and non-free school meal kids did things differently, had different cultures. And that's what we set out to try and interrogate.
Sounds like quite the challenge, though, as you say, from a research perspective, how to try and pin down this slightly kind of mysterious and unknowable thing that's kind of almost in the air, and actually start to put some trends and words and ideas to it. So how did you actually go about doing it?
Yeah, it was certainly something that we had to give a lot of thought to. And as I said, I think from the get-go, we knew that what we'd need to do is, this wasn't this wasn't the type of research where you get hold of lots of data and look through it en masse. It's kind of the opposite kind of activity where you go into a relatively small number of schools and spend time and look in detail. So that was the overall nature of the research project. We started with quite an extensive literature review, essentially looking at the question of what kinds of school cultures and practices impact positively on the attainment of disadvantaged pupils. So as you can imagine, there are all kinds of aspects of a school's culture that have been identified in research or the literature as supporting disadvantaged pupils, from the way that behaviour is managed and attendance is managed, to the way that parents are engaged, the way that data and evidence are used, and the general kind of leadership and management, staffing, the way all this is handled. All of these things have an impact on how kids do in a school. But we carried out a literature review to make sure we didn't miss any key areas, so that our observations and our interviews touched on the whole range of stuff that could potentially have an impact, because culture impacts everything in a school. From the way that, you know, staff meetings are conducted and the ethos and the words that you might find in a school's mission statement, right down to the way that a child's behaviour is managed in a class.
And was it easy to get schools to be involved in the research?
Once we had this kind of set of areas, so areas of culture and practice that could potentially be important, we then set about finding, we ended up with a sample of 17 primary schools and 16 primary schools and 7 secondaries. The numbers are always hard to remember a year on. It did come back to me. So 23 schools in total. We approached, that was roughly like a 30% return on the number of schools that we actually approached, which I think isn't too bad, because what we asked of schools was to spend 2 days in their school interviewing senior leaders, teachers, having a focus group with a group of parents, a focus group with some pupils, carrying out observations over the course of the 2 days, and to ask a small group of pupils to conduct a diary task. So during the course of 2 days at school and at home, they would write down, draw, express, to whatever medium they could on a notepad and a pen.
That was interesting.
Yeah, some of the best stuff came out of those diaries, but we gathered a lot of data. And so I was actually really heartened. It took a lot of work. Recruiting schools for this kind of study is always a big challenge. It's something that we do have a lot of expertise in, but despite that, like I said, you know, 30% of the schools that we contacted and nudged and spoke to took part in the end, which we couldn't have done the research without them. But in each of those schools, we spent 2 days, and then we came back and analysed everything that we got out of the schools.
And did you share quite a bit of what you learned kind of back to them directly before you did the report?
Yeah, that was one of the nicest aspects of the research, because when you're in a school, you know, 2 days is not long. During the course of a school year, it's the blink of an eye. But we were really, I think once we'd reassured staff that we weren't a group of Ofsted inspectors, it was once something that we knew would probably be a concern before we went in, and it was the case some staff assumed that we were some kind of inspector or some people from the local authority or someone from the MAT. So once we'd got past that, which was a completely understandable concern, we were able to have some really, really good conversations. Lots of schools, when you're conducting this kind of research, are keen to know kind of on the fly, you know, what are you finding? What are you seeing? Mm. Because even though we don't know their schools anywhere near as well as they do, we're an external perspective. We're not inspectors. So we weren't looking for or trying to measure or quantify the usual kind of things that people do when they go into schools. We were looking at lots of things that aren't, for instance, you know, what's behaviour like in the dinner hall? Is it managed in the same way as it is in the classrooms? If you walk around the playground for 15 minutes, what's going on there? How do non-teaching staff interact with pupils? Those were some of the kind of things we were looking at. I think schools thought was quite interesting. I thought, no one's really looked at that for a while. What are you seeing?
Yeah.
Also, you know, the design of the study meant that we were going into some schools who their attainment, at least if you pull up the data, was quite low. They may have had quite a big gap between their free school meal and non-free school meal kids. That stuff that they were aware of, we made it clear that's why we were going into their particular school. some of those schools approaching Ofsted inspections, and they were keen to know, like, what are we doing? What have you seen in other schools? Mm. That's probably the second way in which I think we were able to be a helpful voice for schools during the research, is if we'd just been down the road as another school, or we'd recently been in London and now we were in a school down in rural Cornwall, they were fascinated to know what we were seeing in these other schools, to learn or just to hear a different perspective, see if they were doing things similarly or differently. And those are some of the highlights of the research for me, just having these conversations and kind of joining schools
together.
Actually
getting it back to the people who are going to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. And after the research, we then had a roundtable. So at the DfE, a good number of the schools who were involved in the research came to the DfE, which was a really big ask. And we were able to spend 2 or 3 hours. They'd seen the report to discuss the findings. And we had some really good, in some cases, quite critical conversations about the things that we'd concluded. You know, schools, for instance, who were part of a set of what we'd called lower performing schools. Like I said, although we were candid about labelling them that way, that's a difficult thing to...
Yeah. You
know, the design of a research project is always going to have a point where it comes up against the reality. We know that there aren't high-performing schools and lower-performing schools, but when you're designing a research project where you want to know what are the best schools doing, you sometimes have to frame things quite crudely. And it was good to have that chance to sit down with some of those schools and say, yeah, I completely understand why you're probably not too keen being selected as part of that sample of schools. And they were doing lots of great stuff as well. Yeah. This wasn't about saying to those schools, you know, you're not doing any of the stuff that these schools are doing. You need to completely change what you're doing.
Mm.
Often working in really difficult contexts as well. So that was really nice. It's nice to have that chance to actually talk to the people who are involved in a research project and say, look, did we get anything wrong? Do you think we've been unfair?
Yeah, rather than just kind of print it and walk away. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And we'll obviously link to the report in the notes from the podcast.
Right.
But what are the kind of main findings and kind of conclusions?
I think one of the takeaway findings is that we didn't actually find much difference. If you look across the whole report, everything that we looked at, which is about, once we gathered everything in, we essentially took kind of 14,000 items of data, whether it's a picture in a student diary, a line from an interview. So 14,000 items of stuff. Once we looked at it all, there were obviously, all the schools were doing things slightly differently, but there were some really common elements across all of the schools. So actually schools tended to manage behavior in pretty much the same sorts of ways. Mm. They tended to handle and use data in pretty much the same kinds of ways. But the devil was almost in the detail.
Yeah.
We found that in general, schools that that seemed to serve disadvantaged pupils better in terms of their outcomes were, they had greater consistency of culture and practice. So they'd be using that behaviour management system, but firstly, staff would understand why they were using that system. It hadn't just been imposed, but they got the logic of it. They believed that it worked and were convinced that it worked, but also you'd see the same thing happening across the school. I know that's probably not a very new message for the people listening, but I think it's useful to be reminded of that. And in some cases, I mean, the schools weren't necessarily doing exactly the same thing, but the consistency is almost what mattered more. It often came down to a belief that what they were doing was making a difference, and that it went beyond a mission statement, for instance. Lots of schools have the same sort of culture voiced in their mission statement.
Yeah.
But it can break down quite quickly once you get below the level of a senior leadership team into the really busy team of teachers, and then into parents and pupils. Mm. You can quickly lose sight of that ethos or that vision statement of what the school is trying to do. But in many of the really high performing schools, we even heard parents managing behaviour in the playground, for instance, using the, you know, saying to kids that they might have come across in the playground who weren't interacting with their own children the way they would have wanted to and went to the same school, you know, hey, you know, remember what the school tells you about how to do this, or remember the culture ethos of your school, which we thought was quite profound. So schools were doing things that parents understood and got the logic of, and actually permeated outside the school gates to shape the social lives of the kids more broadly.
It must be fascinating, actually, like you say, the consistency point, but also to sort of, through the diary, see your school through the eyes of a pupil and actually, yeah. you know, are different members of staff interacting with them differently, and or as you would expect, because you can't do that level of monitoring and scrutiny yourself as a senior leader, but like actually seeing it from the ground up. It
was definitely fascinating. And it's, I think people diaries were, they were a real insight into the kind of day-to-day things that can disturb or disrupt learning as well. Lots of the diaries were quite kind of poignant insights into how a day can be disrupted for a young person. This wasn't necessarily anything that came out in particular types of schools, but it was just a really good reminder of how something quite small, if it's not managed well in a school, can really disrupt a young person's learning. One other key finding that comes to mind for me as well is, again, I mentioned that schools were broadly doing the same things with data, but we found radically divergent kind of confidence in doing that, particularly in governing teams. So I think often schools that got really good results for disadvantaged kids benefited from strong governing bodies who knew their stuff and had confidence when it came to key things like data and finance.
Yeah.
And when we spoke to governing teams in other schools, sometimes we just it became rapidly clear that they weren't particularly literate with data and they weren't confident. And I think what that allows a school to do when it has a governing body that is hot on that stuff is to take some of the strain. You know, it shouldn't have to be a huge part of a teacher's job or even a senior leader's job to interrogate the data and to know forensically what the data is telling them. I think governing body can provide a really useful check and balance, but if you don't have that at all, you're not being supported to ask those questions and see what the data is telling you. So we found really real differences, I think, in the calibre of governing bodies too.
Yeah, and I guess it's how data is used, whether it is a stick to beat people with or genuinely as a kind of diagnostic, now I understand where I need to put more emphasis, or the something that I've experienced a lot in governance is whether or not you can actually say the impact of something. You know, is there enough understanding of what's changed in the data and why it's changed?
Yeah.
To move on, or are we just looking at the same? Oh, well, that's down again, and we don't know why, kind of thing.
Yeah. If teachers understand and are on board with why they're having to gather so much data and process so much data, then that really helps. And we did find in high performing schools in general that there was a better sense of, essentially, data was seen as something that could support disadvantaged people's learning rather than just meeting an accountability framework, the requirements of an accountability framework. And that's a really good example actually of how people can do the same thing. The practice is exactly the same, but the culture behind it is very different. And that's the crucial thing. People doing the same thing, but for different reasons. One is far more sustainable and motivating than the other.
And obviously data has a huge impact on workload. And if you're doing something that you don't actually feel is improving outcomes, but it's just taking up your time and your energy, that's a very different situation to be in than if you say, if you actually feel like it's a tool for improvement.
Yeah.
And obviously, the focus of your research was looking at, closing that disadvantage gap. In your opinion, maybe this isn't something that you have sort of data and evidence on, but what is the link between pupil performance and that cultural piece? Is it just that consistent systems and this kind of thing free people up to really focus on the teaching and learning, and you know, just behavior distractions out the way? How do you think it links?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think in the report we were quite honest. Like fairly early on in the report, we make it clear that we know we can see how the causal link can flow both ways, and actually the majority of the evidence we gathered, I suppose, suggested links between how a school performs and the culture it has. But those causal links, in terms of the direction of causality, it could flow both ways. It was when you step into a school that, for instance, has the cushion of a good or outstanding Ofsted, a recent good or outstanding Ofsted rating, is well above floor targets, has a supportive parent community. It's undeniable that school has, and the staff in that school have more space, a little bit more breathing space, more time to I suppose to do the nice to haves above and beyond the core of the job. What was really impressive though is that in many schools that I think some would have openly described themselves as fairly beleaguered. So amid funding cuts in parts of the country where there weren't many schools, some in quite rural locations, for instance, they were very much a kind of a school on their own, and may not have had a recently good rating. They knew that they were struggling on attainment. So a school, some of the schools that were really having to work hard and were candid about that, still managed to find time, for instance, not to cut extracurricular provision, or still found time to really work hard at engaging parents, spending long days sometimes doing that, well beyond the core hours that teachers were doing. And that was, as someone who's never taught before, that stuff never ceases to impress me, really. There's something about those schools where they knew that to get to where they wanted to get to, they couldn't just do the basics and do the core. So I think parental engagement is probably one of the best examples, actually, of some of the schools recognised that young people only spent a certain amount of their time with the teachers in the school, within the school gates. You didn't just find parents in school for parents' evenings or to watch an assembly, but parents would be very much part of the life of the school. They'd come in to do workshops with their children to see the particular learning techniques that were being deployed in maths or in English and to do some work alongside them. And those sorts of activities instantly make a difference between parental engagement that's quite transactional, you know, parents knowing what's going on in the school, but essentially being quite transactional, and parental engagement where parents really feel like the school is passing them some of the responsibility. So it's kind of like co-production, really. Like, parents are part of the process of ensuring that kids do well at the school. That was quite a key element of the culture in schools that performed well.
Yeah.
And then you can see causal links. It's not too hard to see how that's going to impact positively. But I guess as I started out, the links flow the other way as well. It's quite a difficult question.
I guess there's also the link around leadership and management, the sort of vision and values that is set from the top of the organisation, not just the kind of culture as and when you find it, that more intangible stuff, the kind of systematic, strategic approach from the top plays a role. I was interested in some of the ideas around like the language that's used, and again, the shared language and the rest of the staff and school's community's understanding of what the leader, I guess, would be trying to build, and whether or not all of that aligns.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thinking of those school leaders, obviously the ones that you worked with had many, many data points for you to share back to them as to what culture really looked like in their school. And it's obviously difficult if you're a school leader to get a sense of these things because people behave themselves when you're around. how might someone go about getting a bit more of an understanding of their own culture, particularly if they want to sort of reflect on it or inconsistency is an issue? Do you have any suggestions as to how they might do that?
Yeah, we were going back to the way that we do research at CFEY. We were keen that this report wasn't just a report, but also there was kind of a practical toolkit for school leaders and teachers as a result of it. So it's something I'm still working on, but we are developing a really short, we call it a toolkit, but really it's just essentially a short document which makes some suggestions about how school leaders can actually try and get under the hood of their own school culture. And I suppose ask the questions that they often don't really have that much time to ask. So we've suggested everything from making a space in your visitor's book for anyone who comes in and out of the school to write down three words which will describe the kind of atmosphere in the school that day. So it's really obvious. And, you know, we're not talking about looking for peer-reviewed standards of robust research, but actually whether it's a contractor who's coming to do some building work, a parent who's popped in, a volunteer or a supplier, or a visitor from the local authority or from the trust, it's really useful to have that external perspective sometimes. I think, you know, leaders and teachers in a school can all have quite a, they might feel like they all know what the ethos of the school is, but actually when you get the external perspective, you might get a different picture. So that's something that we suggested. And then at at the end of the week, you can have a flick through and think, oh, someone thinks that it felt, that the early years felt cold, or or this, they went into a particular classroom and saw a completely different style, the behaviours being managed very differently. So that's something kind of experimental that we suggested. We will have some kind of specific recommendations or suggestions, not really recommendations actually, they're all just suggestions for things, for instance, that a conversation a head might have with their chair of governors. All schools have quite different governance structures, but essentially a chat with the chair of governors about kind of auditing the confidence that governors have with data. So it could just be through interviews or conversations, or it might even be a case of having a little task that you give to governors. But again, it's all quite light touch stuff, but it forces that question of, okay, actually, what kind of grip do our governing body have on data? And if there are confidence gaps, it's not about saying, crikey, we don't have the team we need. It's about saying, okay, well then let's do a course. Let's bring in someone that can spend an hour with those governors to boost their confidence and give them the core skills they need. And a final idea that we are suggesting is that at the start of a week, maybe a slightly lighter week if they exist for heads at all. That's probably quite a controversial thing to say. Very, very cautiously. But would be to look at their school's motto or mission statement, or whatever they have on the banner at the front of the school, or a word that they think is a core part of their culture or ethos. To have that in mind, so kind of stick it on their monitor with a post-it. But then as they walk around the school, so if they're doing a learning walk or they're covering a lesson, to have that part of their school culture in mind, and to see if the practices that they're actually observing, the actual tangible stuff, fit with that. And if they do, that's interesting. If they don't, that's also interesting. But rather than try and, essentially what we're suggesting there is that a school culture can't be held all at once sometimes. In order to try and observe it, you need to distill it into its component parts, and then to go to walk around your school and think, okay, if consistency is a key part, or inclusion, for instance, am I seeing inclusive practice in this school? What does that mean?
Yeah, and I think it is interesting because there does seem to be almost a dividing line sometimes mentally, because where these values are being so explicitly modelled for children and pupils, versus, oh, actually, like, in that team meeting, did we show respect, or, you know, whatever the thing might be, that you're so busy focusing on you know, the aspect of getting the job done, and you go, is this? And I think there must be a link with those schools where it is applied consistently, that, you know, it happens at every interaction, every touch point of humans to humans, not just in front of the children to the children.
Definitely. And I think, for instance, the way in which schools approached NQTs or more junior teachers is a really good example of that. So there was actually quite a wide divergence in the extent to which schools saw bringing in NQTs as a real opportunity to grow people, and you know, somewhat selfishly, to shape them into the kind of teacher they want at their school. But they saw it as a real opportunity, in the same way that they would look at all of the pupils coming in through the gate in the morning. But other schools simply didn't share that. They saw it as almost a burden. One that we completely understand. When you're a school that is in difficulty, having junior members of the team who need more support, it's time and it's effort, but there is a real distinction between those two approaches. And so, as you said, that you can find that a school might not always treat its staff in the way that it might treat its pupils, but interesting things can happen if you just ask yourself that question. And we're not saying any of this stuff is easy, and that there's one way to do it, but these were interesting things that we observed. They're questions that might be useful for teachers and leaders to explore.
Exactly, and as you say, this is a study in culture and a research piece, but a lot of schools very busy doing all the things that they have to get done. Just there hasn't been the time and space for them to think about this. But this is provocative and ideas from it. We've talked about some of the sort of common practice that you saw where strong cultures exist. And you mentioned parents. Would you say successful schools do tend to involve stakeholders a bit more in the process, like pupil voice and you know, hearing from staff more frequently, or staff buy-in into decisions and that kind of thing?
I think the main one is probably parental engagement. Yeah. That's where we saw most diversity. Student voice, for instance, was almost like behaviour management. There was most schools did similar things there. Mm. And all of the schools that we went into, there was a real life to student voice, for instance. But parental engagement is where things differed. As I mentioned earlier, the schools where attainment for disadvantaged pupils was higher, where they did something different with parental engagement, it's often just because they've been doing it for longer. In schools whose attainment for disadvantaged pupils was lower, they were beginning to do some of those things, but they were just newer in the process, so it hadn't yet gathered momentum. But yeah, bringing in parents to actually share learning with their children, to see what the school was doing, and to really understand the ethos. Often coming in for more informal sessions where they come in, have a coffee, there might be one or two teachers, but essentially kind of building a community of parents so they felt comfortable in the school. There might not be a particular objective to that session, but making the school a space that parents can feel at home in is a really tall order. It's a difficult ask.
Yeah.
But we saw that sort of stuff going on that went above and beyond, so that you didn't just have parents coming in for parents' evening, and that's the kind of the sum total of their engagement.
Yeah.
And we all know how much value then flows from parents being more engaged in their children's learning and feeling comfortable and confident to do that.
Yeah.
It's no easy feat, but we did see a real difference in the way that schools did that parental engagement work.
Great stuff. And what I say, we'll obviously link to the report, and you mentioned that there are some tools on the horizon.
There are some tools on the horizon. Yeah.
I won't pin you down to a date.
No, they've already taken longer than I had hoped, and I'm really keen to have those out there. So there will be a very light touch toolkit, which we're excited to get feedback on and see if people use it.
Fantastic. And we will of course share that when it becomes available.
Brilliant.
So thank you, Sam, and thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.